In this episode, I am joined by Robert Nagorny, a physician who founded his cancer center in California and is using all the tools at his disposal to make better treatment decisions for his patients. The episode begins with an overview of his work and his vision on how to approach cancer and cancer treatment, followed by a more detailed view on the use that his team makes of metabolomics in practice. We discuss the benefits for patients and how relevant metabolomics is to a personalized form of medicine that is at the heart of Robert Nagorny's work. One of the highlights for me was to hear how the metabolic signatures that his team uncovered may not only be predictive of disease-free survival, but may also inform on whether treatment is required at all for the patient. Listen in on this episode and don't forget to connect on LinkedIn to continue the conversation that we start today with Robert Nagorny. Welcome back to The Metabolomist for a third season, where we will dive into the concrete applications of metabolomics and where this tool will impact society in the next 5 to 10 years.
I am Alice Limonciel.
This year, I am joined by a diverse group of scientists, medical doctors, and other professionals who have used metabolomics and pushed it beyond just descriptive studies and towards applications that will or are already impacting people's lives. And this year, the key word is really impact. Like you, I know the potential of metabolomics. In the last two seasons, I've discussed with many metabolomists about how powerful, sensitive, and informative metabolomics can be. But this year, I want to zoom in on the impact, the applications that are or soon will be changing our lives for the better. Welcome to The Metabolomist. Today, I am joined by Robert Nagorny. Hello, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here, Robert. You're originally from Connecticut, and you studied chemistry, biochemistry, and then completed residency in internal medicine at University of California, Irvine, followed by a fellowship training in medical oncology in Georgetown University, and then another fellowship in hematology at the Scripps Institute. At this institute, you also started collecting, or maybe you had other ones, but you collected one of your many awards, the Scripps Institute Young Investigator Award, for your work there. And after serving as the medical director of the Todd Cancer Institute, you founded your very own Nagorny Cancer Institute, which is a cancer research center located in Long Beach, California. And there you pioneered the development of what you call functional profiling in human tumors applying a 3D tissue explant technology. This platform uses human tumor biopsies to measure the effect of chemotherapy, targeted agents, and combinations to select treatments for cancer patients. And what you've shown is that it can provide a twofold improvement in clinical response and a significant improvement in survival. You're also given a TEDx talk on that topic, where you discuss how the study of drugs that affect cellular metabolism are going to be the next generation of targets in cancer therapy. And so for these reasons and more, I'm really happy to welcome you today on the podcast so that we can discuss how metabolomics helps you to reach those goals. What motivated you to go from chemistry, biochemistry to medical studies?
Well, first again, thank you for having me. I think the switch actually, I started off a family of physicians. My grandfather and my uncle were all doctors. And so when I was quite young, I decided I wanted to be a doctor. And as I was proceeding in my college studies, I realized that the best basis for that work would be chemistry. Mm-hmm. So my undergraduate work and degree in chemistry led me to interest in biochemistry. And I did basic research as an undergraduate in biochemistry, mostly signal transduction, which was quite new then. Cyclic AMP, actually, protein kinase A-mediated phenomenon. As I finished my medical studies and went into my residencies, I was always interested in the chemistry of life. I've always believed that. And when I finally finished my medical oncology at Georgetown in Washington and my second studies at Scripps Institute, mostly hematologic, I always felt that cancer was a biochemical abnormality, that the ultimate goal of the cancer physician was to discover the metabolic origin of the disease. And as you might appreciate, that was not a popular position. We have a generation or two of learned molecular biology as the only platform to pursue. What I was interested in was in phenotype, cellular biology at the level of the cell. So working in collaboration with a colleague from the National Cancer Institute, I became interested in the study of human cellular response to injury and human cellular response to deprivation and human cellular response to cytotoxic drugs and radiation, and began my work on the study of human tumor primary culture explants, as we call them. What I wanted to point out was that as I went from my original studies in biochemistry and moved into cancer biology, I felt that cancer was a window on human biology, that the disease state itself told us what the normal state was. And interestingly, as you may know, this is the 100th anniversary of the discovery of insulin, Banting and Best in Toronto. And so what they showed was that the state of insulin deficiency enabled them to isolate insulin. They learned what insulin was because they learned what it was not to have it. And in a way, cancer biology is a mechanism to look at normal biology. It's an abnormality of the normal that allows you to see what normal actually is. So what became most interesting to me was the paper published in 1972. It was a little before my scientific career, but a paper published in 1972 in the British Journal of Cancer by Kerwiley and Curry, who described for the first time formally the concept of programmed cell death, the idea that cancer cells did not necessarily grow faster than their counterparts, but instead had developed methods to stay alive and outlive their cancers. I wrote a book called Outliving Cancer, and the subtitle is Cancer Cells Don't Grow Too Much, They Die Too Little, and Why That Matters. And it turns out that cancer as a disease state is a disease state of cellular longevity. So the question then became, what is it that keeps cancer cells living? How do they stay alive when the normal body, the trillions of cells that make up our body, are asking these cells when they're damaged, when they're mutated, when they're no longer useful, asking these cells to die so that they can be replaced by healthy functional cells? So programmed cell death became fundamental to my interest in studying cancer. How is it that these cancer cells, when we treat patients, why do they get better? What happens? What happens when a chemotherapy drug or radiation is administered? So we developed a technique we call the ex vivo analysis of programmed cell death. This modeled human tumor biology in a test tube environment, starting with a surgical biopsy, a specimen removed from the body. We process this using mechanical and enzymatic disaggregation with density centrifugation and elutriation to provide us aggregates in their native state that look for all the world like the original tumor. So when a patient comes to me and we do surgery and we take the tissue out and place it into our test tube environment, if I am to take those slides over to a pathologist, they can make a diagnosis from my slide. The cancer cells are reproduced in their native state. Once the cells are processed, they're distributed into modified media, and then drugs and combinations of drugs and sequences of drugs and targeted agents and combinations of targeted agents with cytotoxic drugs and metabolic inhibitors are introduced into the culture environment. At this point, with 3 to 4 days of tissue culture, 72 to 96 hours, the cells commit to cell death or not. Now, we did very early studies on this, and we were able to look at DNA degradation patterns, and we could show that cells that were likely to die from chemotherapy or toxic exposures would commit to death within 4 or 8, certainly 16 to 20 hours. So the window of 72 to 96 hours was a definitive measure of cell death, largely mediated by the loss of membrane integrity. And over time, we developed additional measures, including ATP content by luciferase and mitochondrial function at the level of succinate dehydrogenase, caspase activations. We've developed a lot of tools. But fundamentally, what happens is cancer cells go from being happy to dying. And when they do, you can gauge their relative sensitivity to the injury by concentrations of drugs required. So we use LC50, lethal concentration 50%, as a measure. And using that, we can compare you to all of the 10,000 patients we've studied. We can then come up with a general algorithm as to whether you're likely to respond or not. And as you mentioned, we can generally about double responses and improve survival. We reported an update of that work at the American Association for Cancer Research this past year, the most recent meeting in 2023, held in Orlando, Florida. And it was an update on all of our published papers, of which there are many, none of which have been negative. It's that we have, in every instance where we have shown a comparison between standards of care and our technology, we have always provided superior outcomes. What was also interesting about that presentation, though, was we were able to show in meta-analyses, in a hematologic meta-analysis with over 1,900 patients, a 2.48-fold higher response rate, and in solid tumor combinations, a 2.04-fold higher response rate, and interestingly, superior survival, 1.44-fold, and all of this is part of that presentation from last year. Well, I wanted to double back on a paper we had presented at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, which was the meeting for clinical therapists. The AACR is more basic science, basic developmental work. ASCO is clinical. So some years ago, we conducted a clinical trial where we prospectively evaluated the laboratory model to predict outcome, not only predict outcome, but to actually choose treatments. Now, back in the early 2000s or 2010 range, the response to treatment for non-small cell lung cancer was about 31%. And the median overall survival was about 12 months. And so the paper, the study, was designed to double response rate and to double the median progression-free survival, which we did. So on this presentation from 2010 or 11 at ASCO, made it possible for us to examine what we were actually seeing. When these cancer cells were dying in vitro, the question was, what was causing them to die? Now, there has been a profusion of people who clamor that apoptosis, one form of programmed cell death, is the form of programmed cell death. And it is increasingly obvious that that is highly and foolishly simplistic. Cancer cells do not commit to a single form of death. They commit to death, and then they choose their route. So it may be calcium-mediated, it may be PARP-mediated, it may be necroapoptotic, it may be ferroapoptotic. It may be apoptotic, it may be para-apoptotic, but the point is cells either grow and survive or die. We began to become interested in looking under the microscope, what do cells do when they're damaged? What happens when a breast cancer patient's tissue is exposed to a widely used drug, doxorubicin? And we began to realize that the doxorubicin injury would either result in cell death or not. But what was most interesting is when you looked morphologically and you used special stains to examine these slides, what you saw in a given patient's tissue exposed to adriamycin, doxorubicin, what you saw in the test tube under 250-fold magnification was that the cells chose their own mode of death. In the same patient's breast cancer, some of the cells that died by apoptotic morphology with nuclear shrinkage and fragmentation. Some of them died by necrotic morphology, where you could see that the cells basically explode. And some, I don't show the staining here, but some by lipid staining are actually undergoing a state of autophagy. So in every given patient, the response can be very complicated. And I think that's why some of the groups right now who are trying to use apoptosis measures or others are overly simplifying this process. Cancer cells live or die by methods that they choose. So what became very obvious to us was that cancer cell death was ultimately biochemical. It was ultimately the loss of metabolic viability. Cancer cells don't die because their DNA is damaged. Cancer cells don't die because they can't proliferate. Cancer cells die because there is a program contained within every cell that says that we cannot repair the damage, we cannot overcome the stress, and we must commit suicide. Cancer is not murdered by chemotherapy. It's convinced to commit suicide. And the suicide that the cancer commits, programmed cell death, can be apoptotic, necroapoptotic, ferroapoptotic, or a whole host of other mechanisms. The fundamental unifying field theory of cancer biology that unequivocally connects all of these is the loss of metabolic viability. So what we thought we needed to figure out where the connections between cell death, cell injury, and metabolism, we needed a Rosetta Stone. we needed a vehicle that would connect the events of cell death with the biochemistry of cell death. And working in collaboration with Dr. Paolo Damora, who was here working with us here in California from the Federal University, our colleague Ismail Dao, our very good colleagues here at UC Irvine, Robert Bristow, Krishna Tiwari, Fabio Cappuccini, our fellows, and my lab staff here, we crafted a Rosetta Stone to connect chemotherapeutic response to metabolic event. The paper, published in 2021 in Gynecologic Oncology, Platinum Resistance and Gynecologic Malignancies, Response, Disease-Free, and Overall Survival are predicted by biochemical signature, a metabolomic analysis. This paper, published in 2021, enabled us to conduct a very interesting series of experiments. To explain the outline of the study, 51 patients were accrued to the trial who were all candidates for surgery for advanced ovarian cancer. The patients were admitted to our affiliate medical center. They were consented, and they agreed to submit to us tissue from their ovarian surgery and blood for the isolation of plasma. The concept of the study was A, using their tissue in our platform, our ex vivo analysis of programmed cell death, could we identify the platinum sensitive and platinum resistant patients? Now, for those of your audience who don't know that distinction, in ovarian cancer, the most important drug that we use is cisplatin or carboplatin. Every patient with ovarian cancer gets everybody. So there is a fundamental dividing line in patients with ovarian cancer as to whether they're platinum sensitive or platinum resistant. It's the principal determinant of survival in this disease.
I guess so far there's no known way of discriminating between those two groups.
Exactly. And so everybody gets it. So what we said was, well, it's very likely that we can find the ones that are sensitive and the ones that are resistant. So we first proved, and here's the survival curve approaching 5 years, that if you're sensitive to cisplatin, the likelihood of your responding and remaining in remission and surviving is demonstrably better. That was something that I'd been working on for many years. Once again, in a prospective trial, was clearly established to predict survival. And I admit to you that people are not, unfortunately, using this very widely, although it is clearly a very good tool for selecting amongst candidates and how aggressively to manage them. In any case, what we had done here was show that, yes, sensitivity to platinum can be predicted, and it has a big impact on survival. But what was very interesting was, could we show metabolic correlate of platinum sensitivity? That is, were the patients who were responding to platinum, were they just responding to platinum because their DNA fell apart, or were there features of their biology that predicted their response to platinum based not on genomics or P53 status, but based on cellular metabolism, bioenergetics, and the capacity of cells to respond to the stress, which in this case is chemotherapy. So this is one of the equations that we developed, an algorithm that we developed using the Biocrates platforms. We gauged concentrations of individual metabolites and crafted relationships that were strongly correlated with platinum resistance. That is, in this instance, this amino acid and phosphatidylcholine over tryptase, this ratio with an ROCAUC of 0.933, clearly distinguished the platinum-sensitive from platinum-resistant groups. Thereby, people who respond to platinum do so because they don't have the metabolic machinery to resist it. They lack that extra ability to stay alive in the face of the stress. And so the platinum-sensitive resistance is a reflection of cellular metabolism.
If I may interrupt for a second, this ratio was very intriguing to me because for the auditors, what we have is a ratio of valine to phenylalanine divided by a ratio of acyl-carnitine and lysophosphatidylcholine and all of that divided by tryptophan. So it's a very complex formula. Do you know the details of how you reached that formula, or was it just made by an algorithm? Did the computer come up with this, or how did this happen?
What we have the luxury of doing is when we go to the machine learning and AI tools, we give the machine the on-off, the yes-no, and we say segregate these.
Mm-hmm.
So we develop increasingly discriminating metabolic interactions. So the algorithms emanate. It's sort of like knowing the answer and asking the question.
Mm-hmm.
So what we had was the luxury of knowing who gets better, who responds, who survives, and then giving the machine learning capabilities, tell me why this is different from that.
Mm-hmm.
So there were many different ratios, but this one was particularly discriminating. And if you ask me why I think it's discriminating, the valine phenylalanine ratio would reflect largely liver function. Hepatic function in patients is fundamental to health and well-being. The ratios, we think, is the cancer cells tend to cannibalize their structural lipids in favor of energy. And the tryptophan is a reflection of immunity and the Ido-Tido ratios. So we can parse what we think this tells us. But what's so striking is that this is clearly segregating platinum sensitivity and platinum resistance based entirely on a metabolic signature, nothing to do with genomics or DNA repair or any of the tools that other people are trying ineffectively to apply.
Now, I guess this gives also a lot of hope for people who are looking for SNPs or genetic reasons behind either cancers or other diseases, that there are other omics that we can look at to find discriminating factors, for example, to choose treatment or for other types of personalized medicine.
Yes, I think you and I would probably agree we spend too much time on the genotype and not enough time on the phenotype.
Well, there is a lot of time that is spent on genotype, but of course it has brought a lot of things. But I think the more interesting things come when you combine different omics together. So yeah, I think there's a lot of promise there. Okay, thank you. Sorry for the interruption. Please go on.
We found that there are other features of the plasma metabolites that clearly distinguish our platinum sensitive resistance. And again, this is a lipidomic analysis showing that we think that the cells are cannibalizing certain lipids in favor of energy, and that energy is devoted to the cells maintaining viability. So you have a fundamental metabolic shift to maintain the resistance to injury. What became incredibly interesting for us was our ability to then examine survival, patient outcome, durable survival, based entirely on metabolites, while we were interested in and correlated platinum resistance. The ability to predict survivals based on metabolism above and beyond other measures seemed incredibly interesting. And what we were able to show that, again, there were specific ratios that seemed to characterize people with the longest survival against those with the shorter survival. And in this study, where we looked at C8 carnitine over PCAE-36.4 and histidine over PCAE-36.4, those two ratios distinguished perfectly with an AUC at 1.0, the six-year versus the two-year survival. Most patients with ovarian cancer who do not do well are dead in 2 years. So this was a very fundamental distinction between the two groups of those who were likely to achieve remission and those who were likely to fail and die of their disease. And we went on to show that this was statistically significant. This is in the paper, and shows that disease-free survival was clearly predicted by metabolic signature above and beyond P53 or any of the other measures that are used today. This is a complete distinction at 5 years of a group that is 50% still in remission and probably all of whom remained in remission and died of other causes. This is now a several-year-old paper. Or those who had relapsed and died with only about a 10% survival in the bad group. So here we had metabolic signature of survival. Now, this offered an extraordinary opportunity and kind of a accident. One of the patients that accrued to this study, most of the time they were accrued by the research nurses or by the fellows. But one of the patients that was accrued was on the oncology unit when she was preparing for surgery, and I went and introduced myself and told her what we were doing. And she agreed that she would be interested in participating. And we got both consent, both for her tissue and for her blood for the metabolic signature. And I thanked her for her participation, and I didn't think much more about her until about a month later, when this patient returned to my office and said she would like me to assume her care. And I said, well, don't you have capable physicians in the form of your gynecologic oncologist? Couldn't your doctors follow you? And she said, well, I am unwilling to take chemotherapy, and they will not follow me. And I said, you know, you have stage 3 ovarian cancer, and you have to take chemotherapy. I mean, this is a death sentence. And she said, no, I refuse. And I repeatedly argued with her that she should take this. I mean, it's the standard of care for all the reasons in the world. A stage 3 ovarian cancer needs chemotherapy. Everybody would get it. Everyone would give it. Me too. So the patient said, no, I will not take it. Will you follow me? So every 3 to 6 months, I saw her and follow up. I conduct CA-125s, and I evaluated the patient for her well-being, you know, with every expectation that she was going to recur. The patient, however, didn't. And finally, in November of 2021, as we were publishing this paper in the Journal of Gynecologic Oncology, I realized that this patient was part of my clinical study. She was on my trial. And because it was a blinded study and I didn't really know who was who, I had no way of knowing what her metabolic signature was. And I kept wondering, all the time I was following this woman for years, I kept wondering, what is it about this patient that allows her to survive when everyone would have insisted she take chemotherapy, and yet she's alive and well approaching 5 years? So I said, oh, I have her metabolic signature. And when we looked at her, she fell in the group with the best outcome, raising the question whether patient survival is more a matter of the patient and not the treatment.
Didn't you follow the other patients as well to see if they did? So you predicted their outcome, and then you looked at their actual outcome after treatment, except for her, but you checked how they were doing afterwards, right?
Exactly.
And she fell within the group of people who received treatment and responded well to it.
So she turned out to be on the long-term survivorship curve, as we reported, and as we reported in that journal article. Mm-hmm. And when we went back, we realized that, yes, indeed, she was in the best survivor group. The interesting thing being, they all got chemotherapy. She didn't. So there appears to be something very fundamental to our metabolism that not only enables us to respond to chemotherapy or enables us to survive after chemotherapy, but may actually enable us to survive without chemotherapy, which I think is a fascinating possibility, that we might be able to find people who could avoid therapy entirely. To just sort of finish out the concept of this study, we had an interesting idea. I got a note from my colleague Ismail Dell at the Federal University of Sao Paulo. And he wrote me a note a few years ago, and he said, I have a crazy idea. Okay, what is it? I want to study the metabolomics of the secretome. I want to look at what the cells are doing in the tissue culture environment. I want to know if the cancer cells are establishing their own microenvironment and whether we can interrogate it using metabolomic signatures. So we took tumor from patients with ovarian carcinoma who were undergoing our laboratory analysis for drug response profiles, and we set aside media with cells and no drug, just fixed media with known constituents, complete media, modified, and the cells would sit in incubators, follow along during the same period of time that the other patients were being studied for platinum resistance, etc. These tissue cultures were sitting by themselves. They were just cells making and doing what they did in their own little world. No drug, no exposure. The findings were reported at the American Association for Cancer Research a couple of years ago. And it's just fascinating, because what we were able to show using lipidomic measures was that we could predict which patients were likely to achieve pathologic complete remission, which is tantamount to cure, 4 days after we met them using lipidomic profiles. And here are two of the findings with very high AUCs, 1.95. And basically, these are phosphatidylcholine and phosphatidylcholine ratios that distinguish patients likely to achieve complete remission and go on to cure, as opposed to those who are likely to fail to achieve remission and likely to go on to die from their disease. And this is now in final preparation for publication. Dr. DeMora is completing this study. But we're doing this not only in ovarian cancer now, but we're doing it in all disease. And we're looking at this secretome phenomenon, which I think is another very interesting angle on all this. I'm going to finish, and I apologize that I didn't know that this paper would be published by the time you and I were speaking. And thank you again for your invitation. But when you invited me to speak, you asked if there was a paper I would discuss, and this wasn't in press. So I was a little hesitant to talk about an unpublished paper, but less than a week ago, this manuscript was published in Metabolite. So just to finish, we think that these metabolic platforms have application in all cancers, and in fact, perhaps in all diseases. Here we have shown in our study diagnostic and prognostic performance of metabolic signatures in pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, the clinical application of quantitative next-gen mass spectrometry. We have shown that we can both find pancreatic cancer and determine likelihood of survival going out to 15 years. So that would have maybe been a topic of discussion more thoroughly, but it wasn't in press by the time we spoke. So I think with that, I'll finish my discussion of what we did with the ovarian, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. And I think this second paper gives something to look forward to for our auditors as well, that they can dive into this second paper. So I guess there you use a similar approach. It's a different type of cancer, of course, a different set of patients, but it's a similar approach where you also show how using metabolomics you can find new avenues for diagnostic and prognostic for this very aggressive type of cancer. Which is also the case for the other ones that you discussed in the first paper. You make a lot of use of metabolite ratios and you have an original approach. So we've had people who compute their own ratios. For example, we often advise people to look in the literature, find ratios that have worked or that have some sort of biological grounds to them, and then apply that to their data and see if that comes out significant. Other people compute all possible ratios and then see which ones are significant in their study. So I guess you're more on the second side. The machine learning algorithms gave you the ones that were significant to discriminate between your groups and then understood what it could mean on a biological level, right?
Yeah, we actually do both. There are certain ratios that we always look at. One of them is glutamate and glutamine. Another one is tryptophan and kininurin, which we feel are fundamental to cancer biology. We are also very interested in some of the carnitine ratios. So we do often begin with ratios that we are aware of and have very particular biochemical interest in, but we also use a more broad brushed approach, what might be kind of a recursive partitioning and amalgamation kind of concept where you look for groups and slowly segregate the groups. I think both are very attractive avenues.
And when you have these signatures, whether it's the very complex ratio you discussed in the paper or even more simple ones but have a strong effect, what's your next step then to apply this in your practice? Can you directly apply this to advise on the treatment, for example, of patients? Or do you need to demonstrate this in larger cohorts and then it has to be accepted? This is maybe an interesting topic also for the people who are listening, who are doing similar type of research and maybe don't know how you can move this kind of findings to the next level. What is the next step for this kind of discoveries?
We are convinced that the measure of metabolism is fundamental to our understanding of cancer biology. Mm-hmm. And we are convinced that this applies across the board to many diseases. In fact, we have published in breast, ovary, as we discussed, pancreas, as we discussed, mm-hmm. COVID severity, all predicated on a deeper understanding of the biology that goes beyond the genomic basis of disease. We think that these signatures, these findings are quite significant, statistically significant. In fact, some of the prognostic ratios, these are short-chain fatty acid carnitines, some of the prognostic ratios were actually ROC-AUC of 1.0. They were sort of perfect. Mm-hmm. So it leads us to think that if we were to expand the cohorts of these groups to a larger prospective evaluation, that we could confirm unequivocally that these are highly important diagnostics, prognostics, and what I'm looking for are predictives. So that what we would love to do is in patients on, for example, with pancreatic cancer. We have pancreatic cancer patients who are alive 15 years later, metastatic disease alive 15 years later. You will never meet anyone who can say that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to make it sound like we knew that going in. We didn't. What we did with one particular patient was I met him when he was given up on every major institution in Southern California. We have a lot of very high-level cancer research programs here. And everyone said, go home and die. He came to me, his wife is a nurse, came to me and asked if I could help, and I said I would. We did a surgical biopsy of the liver mass, and his liver was filled with cancer. I actually didn't think I could help him. But we did a biopsy, and we found a combination of treatment that worked perfect. I mean, perfect. And he went into complete remission. And it was during the time that we were observing this remarkable response that we said, let's take a look at your biochemistry. Let's see why you got better. What is it about you that makes you such a survivor? A little bit like the woman we talked about with ovarian cancer. And my belief, increasingly, is that it's not what you give, but who you treat. And so in this guy's case, I think the reason he survived was because he was a survivor. Now, yes, I intervened, and yes, I gave him chemotherapy, and yes, he may or might not have done as well with someone else. I don't know that. But I do know that he's alive 14 or 15 years later, and I also know that he had a perfect metabolic signature for survival in pancreatic cancer, which we discovered retroactively by comparing him to all our other cases. He turned out to be a winner that we didn't know we had. It was like finding out you had the winning lottery ticket tucked in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a very favorable profile. So yeah, I think these platforms bring a great deal to diagnosis, prognosis, and ultimately we hope prediction of response.
And is there space to expand this platform or the use of this platform to other centers? Because I guess this is at the moment primarily existing in your cancer center.
Right.
Are there other places where people can have access to this?
We have the luxury of a mass spectrometer on site. And so we are conducting our own patient studies here. We would relish the opportunity to collaborate with institutions using the algorithms we're discovering. We would relish the opportunity to do confirmatory clinical studies. I'm a doctor. I'm a clinician. I treat cancer patients. I came from the hospital this morning to do this interview. And my patients benefit greatly from our ability to select treatments for them. But what I want to know at a greater degree of granularity is not do they get better, but why they get better. And I think metabolism studies may help that. So what we'd love to do, if we could work with groups that have, for example, high throughput of ovarian cancers or breast cancers, which we've published in, or other cancers, actually, we'd love to extend this to lung and colon and sarcoma. We do studies. We've done thousands of studies on site, and we get samples of blood from osteogenic sarcoma in children and from people with, and you know, we've got all manner of data, but we don't have clinical follow-ups on all those diseases. We're just still developing that.
Mm.
So we'd love collaborations. Yes, we'd love to.
Okay, then the message is out in the podcast. I hope that you get that people contact you. We'll put your contact on the page of the episode as well. So let's cross our fingers for this. One other question I had is there are people in the medical field and maybe outside as well who are a bit hesitant to use metabolomics because we know that the metabolome, I mean, the plasma can be influenced heavily by what we eat, by our lifestyle. And some people see this as a detriment to the use of this tool for example, in medicine, because it seems not reliable enough. Your work clearly shows that you can take people who are probably in the same geographic area or a relatively small geographic area, but who most likely have different lifestyle, absolutely don't have the same type of diet, but there's no reason why they would. And you can still find things that are very relevant to the disease they have or to their responsiveness to treatment and doesn't seem to be heavily influenced by diet. Has this been a criticism that you've received in the, over the years?
Well, I actually entered into the field skeptical. Mm-hmm. To be honest, that when I began to look at the mass spec platform, my great fear was that people could influence their results and that I would get spurious data. The only thing we've done so far for our studies is we've controlled acquisition of sample by requesting that everyone fast for 12 hours.
Which is standard, yeah.
And so beyond that, your point is both well taken, but also very informative, because people do have different lifestyles and people do have different diets. And what we find is that they don't always know what the right diet and lifestyle is. So I think if you can begin to get a measure of their biochemical well-being, whether it be cancer-related or other, at least as long as you can standardize the methodology for procuring the blood and, normal conditions, I believe that this could be extremely important for identifying disease predisposition.
In a similar line, you probably also hear a lot about the possible contribution of the gut microbiome to health and disease. This is also a field where metabolomics plays a big role, where it's starting to be used to understand what the microbiome does, how it contributes to our health. For example, there's a paper that came out last year where a group from Hamburg in Germany showed that one specific microbial metabolite, indole acetic acid, allowed them to predict who would respond to treatment, and also supplementing that metabolite could increase the responsiveness to treatment, at least in a mouse model that was similar to the humans. Is that something that you've looked into or that you plan to look into in your work?
You know, in the book that I wrote some years ago, Outliving Cancer, in one of the chapters, I mentioned lumpers and splitters. And I characterize myself as a lumper. What that means is there are people who want to define things by very narrow biological findings and those who want to put them all together. And I unequivocally want to put these together. What we have in modern medicine is that we have siloed everybody's expertise. So the gene guys don't talk to the protein guys, and the protein guys don't talk to the metabolic guys, and the metabolic guys don't talk to the transcriptomic guys. I mean, I'm a doctor. I have a much higher calling. It's called the Hippocratic Oath. I'm trying to save lives. And so everybody has to kind of tone down their egos a little bit, begin to realize the utility of every specialty. I'm extraordinarily impressed by microbiome studies. And we have interacted with people who are experts in the microbiome. And we find, as you show, your indole acetic acid is likely what you're finding is a tryptophan metabolite, because that is the downstream event of tryptophan metabolism. Mm-hmm. Tryptophan metabolism is fundamental to our well-being, and we see it repeatedly in our breast cancer studies, in our ovarian cancer studies, as you saw from our equation with tryptophan on the bottom. This is a measure of a neutral amino acid absorption through the gut, largely influenced by the microbiome and the health of the gut. Also, by the activity of Ido and Tito. So these are all very important. One of the points we find, one of the points we make in our pancreas paper, is that some of the people appear to have a state of malnutrition. Is it possible that the cancer of the pancreas arises in a microbial environment where nutrients that are necessary for our normal metabolism are depleted, and the pancreas cells seeking its nutrient needs mutates or borrows a mutation, rather, actually doesn't mutate, it borrows a mutation so as to survive under a state of deprivation. So is the microbiome important? Incredibly important. One of the factors we find repeatedly is citrulline, which is part and parcel of the ornithine cycle, is to a large degree produced by the microbiome in the gut. So, these are absolutely connected. There's no question.
Thank you. It's really fascinating. I think we're reaching slowly the end of the episode, but I'd still have a couple of questions. And I really appreciate how you mentioned the impact of your work on the patients and what we could call the patient's journey as well. This is always, especially with cancer, but with other diseases as well, the difficult journey that patients have going from one treatment to another, where we do this trial and error on patients rather than, if possible, doing it beforehand. So this is one thing I really appreciate in your approach, that it gives some light to do our homework before and figure out what is the best way to treat this specific patient and then give them not only less suffering and less distress, but also the best chance of survival. Do you maybe have a comment on that aspect of your work and maybe personalized medicine in general?
Well, I would probably say that you've just described my career.
Okay.
We believe wholeheartedly that every patient deserves the best treatment the first time, every time. We use our platform in tissue culture to study drug selection and combinations, even combinations that someone might not think of. What we need is for physicians, particularly those in the larger institutions, to back away from protocol-driven therapy toward individualized therapy. We use our platform for drug selection, but is it possible perhaps that metabolic signatures would also participate in that? I think I invented personalized medicine. I've been doing this for decades, and our responses are remarkably better than everyone else's. I don't want to brag here. It's not like I'm the smartest guy. It's just that in a marathon, I line up at the edge with a bicycle, and I've got a 5-to-1 ratio. I'm going to get to the end of that marathon, and the patient wants me to win the marathon for them. They don't care how I do it. We have to get off the dime on all these protocol-driven therapies and standardized guideline therapies and get down to treating people with the individuals that they are. A human phenotype drives outcome.
Thank you. So I think we're ready for the very last question. I don't know if you remember, but the very last question on the podcast is, what is your favorite metabolite and why? Have you given this some thought?
Yeah, it's a funny question. You know, you mentioned it to me when we first talked about doing that, and I'm sort of up and back. I have two metabolites that are my favorites, and I'm trying to, I hope tryptophan won't feel offended if I say it's glutamate. But the reason I say glutamate is that we started our company Metabolomics, and Metabolomics, the title Metabolomics, is spelled with a M-Y-C.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the reason we did that was because we found that MYC regulation was so fundamental to so many metabolic perturbations. And it's so interesting that although MYC regulates 15% of the genome, and although abnormalities of MYC are found in something like 70% of cancers, MYC is almost never mutated. So it is all the functional biology of MYC, it is all the phenotypic biology of MYC that regulates cancer, and you can't find it at the genomic level. You find it at the functional level. You may find it at the epigenetic level. But the thing is that MYC, the MYC onc chain, drives glutaminolysis. And so I guess if I have to land on a favorite metabolite, I guess it's glutamate.
Thank you very much. It was lovely to discuss with you, and all the best with your work. It's really fascinating and impressive work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Metabolomist. I hope that this episode got you excited about the upcoming applications of metabolomics and that it motivated you to support science that brings a positive impact to our lives. To make sure you never miss an episode, register to our newsletter on the podcast webpage, themetabolomist.com. To learn more about metabolomics and how to plan your own projects, check out my book on metabolomic data interpretation at biocrates.com/thestoryprinciple. And don't forget to connect with me, Anisley Moussiel, on LinkedIn to continue the conversation on the many ways that metabolomics impacts health, research, and our lives.